Welcome to the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. My name is Mark Steven Schwartz, and it's both an honor and a privilege for me to read the diaries of Allied and American civilian prisoners of war interned in and around Kobe, Japan during the Great Pacific War, World War II. No portion of this story can be copied, duplicated, or used in reference in any way, directly or indirectly, without the expressed written permission of Mark Steven Schwartz. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Monday, December 8th, 1941. Charles F. Gregg, 4:30 a.m., Satchel satisfactory weather, released the message, filed for PAA, trip 553, NC-14715, Philippine Clipper, from Wake to Guam. 6:05 a.m., Philippine Clipper departed Wake for Guam. 6:10 a.m., Lieutenant Pinky Elwood Madsen, U.S. Navy Communications Officer, phoned Japanese have now attacked Honolulu, also south of Manila. Hostilities have commenced. Japanese have attacked Honolulu and Manila. Two naval engagements in progress. 6:12 a.m., filed a B radio message to the captain on board the Philippine Clipper. NC-15, San Francisco, Midway Island, and Wake. Terminal conditions on Guam, not satisfactory, not satisfactory. Pending decision from San Francisco headquarters before further release. 6:20 a.m. Advise the chief mechanic, Max Brodowski, port steward, Al Hamilef, and chief radio operator, George Conklin, of emergency status. Max Brodowski, Guam bombed, December 8th, 1941. News had reached us at 6:30 a.m. Guam time of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We waited tensely for the blow, which we were sure would come from Saipan, the Japanese stronghold in the Marianas. 2.5 hours later, a flight of Japanese bombers broke formation and made a shambles of our Pan American Airways compound. They bombed, they strafed, and had things all their own way. Not a single anti-aircraft gun on the island. Charles F. Gregg, 6:45 a.m. After confirming Lieutenant Madsen's report by checking with Governor McMillan's aide, I filed a coded message giving the information at hand. 7:06 a.m. Received word that the Philippine Clipper had returned to Wake and landed. 7:15 a.m. Breakfast. First business at hand, toast to Dr. Jim Epley on his 31st birthday. Then I informed all Pan American personnel at the mess hall of our emergency status, except Jim Thomas, junior airport manager, and Dick Arvidson, radio operator, who were on duty. Advised everyone to immediately pack a suitcase and have it ready on the porch of their quarters. Thomas and Arvidson were so advised later. Assign the men and teams to the truck and the station wagon and assign them the duties of collecting baggage and where to meet the men in case of an attack. Instructed the men to meet at the Marine barracks in case they became separated. Instructed port steward Al Hamilef that food and stores would be handled by the Marines. 7:20 a.m. News broadcast from Australia confirmed Lieutenant Madsen's report. 7:45 a.m. Chamorro Hotel staff, having arrived for work, were informed of outbreak of war and released by Mr. Hamilef to go home if they were not needed, and all of them were to be released if action started on Guam. A Liaison Boy was retained at the Pan Am Hotel to contact the maintenance boys in case a company plane should arrive at Guam. 8:15 a.m. The Chamorro maintenance and operations staff were released in like manner by the hotel personnel. 8:34 a.m. While preparing a coded message to San Francisco headquarters asking for instructions, planes were heard overhead at low altitude. Six Japanese bombers, single-engine twin-float seaplanes, passed over the Marine compound and Commercial Pacific Cable Station, converged over the PAA compound, and released their bombs from approximately 800 feet. First barrage hit the drum storage tank of oil and gas in front of the shop and those on the side of the office next to the boat channel. Plane circled, returned, and dropped more bombs. Hit the Pan Am Hotel in front of the storehouse, hit the huge Standard Oil tank. Two planes with 50 caliber machine guns strafed the Pan American maintenance staff as they were running across the compound. These boys had been released to go to their homes a full 10 minutes before the Japanese planes appeared. However, in true Chamorro fashion, they had congregated in front of Max's shop building to talk about the sudden turn of events, and while so occupied, the first planes were seen approaching. When the first bomb exploded, they started to run in tightly packed groups instead of scattering and lying down. Several were injured by shrapnel. Dean Brunton. When the alarm clock sounded at daylight, December 8th or 7th, for those of you who live east of the international dateline, there was nothing which indicated to me that the day would be any different from most of the pleasant days I had known during my 13 years on Guam. The air was yet filled with the exotic perfume of the ylang ylang, which gives off its fragrance only at night, as I went out into the street. Thus peacefully began the most fateful, certainly one of the most to be remembered days of my life. Small groups were gathered at street corners, and I sensed something extraordinary even before I met Lieutenant Jack Schwartz. Accustomed to meeting all sorts of problems without warning, and with the usual cool analytical mind of his profession, he greeted me in his cheerful manner. Then he added, almost as an afterthought, "I suppose you have heard that we are at war." The blow had fallen. The Great Pacific Powder Keg, of which we had heard so much in recent news comments, had finally blown up. Harold Brinkerhoff. Monday, December 8th rolled around. I left the house for work at 6:30 as usual. I was in charge of a native crew of 110 men. We are constructing some officers' quarters up on the cliff behind Agana. I was quite surprised to be doing this type of work, as I was sure when I first came to Guam that I would be building heavy fortifications. There were absolutely no preparations for a possible Japanese attack, no gun emplacements of any kind. It was a beautiful, clear morning. Rain had fallen during the night. Diamonds of moisture clung to the lower edges of the fern leaves and dripped from the trees and bushes that bordered the path leading up to the project. Life was good. I was happy with the tropics. I thought of my wife and two sons halfway across the world from me. I wondered how soon it would be before they were here to enjoy this tropical paradise with me. On reaching the project, I found my native workmen gathered around a table, cheering two contestants with arms locked in an Indian wrestling contest. Bets were being placed on the winner. The Guam natives will bet on anything from a cockfight to a water buffalo battle. The whistle blew down in Agana at the lumberyard, and our day's work began. Some men were stripping forms from the walls we had poured on Friday. Others were carrying them to put in place for the next building. Jesus Untalan, the native foreman, and I had made up a list of lumber we would need to proceed. At 7:15, while everyone was doing their assigned job, I took off for the Navy lumber yard to check on some material that had not been delivered. I walked leisurely down the road, noticing the bananas and other fruits ripening. There had been a typhoon a month before I arrived that had destroyed most of the fruit, except in the protected areas at the south end of the island. What a paradise! Bananas, pineapple, breadfruit, and papayas for the taking every day of the year. No wonder the natives are such a happy-go-lucky lot. Fish and seafoods abound off the reefs surrounding the island. Coming out of the lumber yard, I met Dean Brunton, my immediate superior. "Have you heard the news?" asked Brunton. From the look on his face, I had a premonition of his answer, even before I asked, "Is it war?" He told me Governor McMillan had received word that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor at daylight. Stunned, I left my list with a yard clerk and hurried back up the hill to the project. When I got there, the workmen were standing around watching three formations of Jap planes, with three planes per formation, winging their way westward towards Petey. In a few moments, we saw them dive on Petey and Sume and could hear the dull thunder of exploding bombs. This was just a few minutes after 8 a.m. I hurried over to the weather station 100 yards away. They had a phone which I used to call the public works office for instructions. Lieutenant Schwartz told me to send my men home so they could get their families out of town immediately. Dean Brunton. The news was not a complete surprise. We who lived on Guam had known for years that all around us the Japanese were building military bases, and local incidents had led me to believe that any day we might find ourselves at war. Three times I had seen with my own eyes unidentified and unmarked planes which had remained for about 2 hours over the island at a high altitude, undoubtedly Japanese, undoubtedly photographing, undoubtedly secure in the knowledge that we had no fighter planes with which to challenge them. Twice I had seen low, gray, powerful fishing boats cruising back and forth between Guam and the nearby Japanese-mandated island of Rota, well within our 3-mile limit. They certainly weren't fishing, though it wouldn't have been difficult to imagine their purpose. Thus, it was not a great surprise when we saw, at about 8:20 a.m., a flight of 9 strange planes. They passed by at about 5,000 feet, southward along the rugged east coast of the island, until they were opposite the Rote Peninsula and the town of Sume. One by one, they dived. In a few seconds, I saw Sume enveloped in flames and smoke. The Pan American Airways area and the Standard Oil tanks had been heavily hit as well. I could see some of the invaders diving towards the harbor, but couldn't see their target. I learned later it was the USS Penguin. The first raid lasted only a few minutes, but since we had no weapons with which to retaliate, and since all the targets had been in vulnerable, exposed locations, damage to us was high, to the Japanese negligible. It is possible the Marines scored some small caliber hits on the enemy, but though their spirits were high and they gave the Japanese all they had, they just didn't have enough to do any real damage. Charles F. Gregg, 9 a.m. Max Prudovsky and Grant Wells, Pan Am chief mechanic and his assistant, respectfully, were off the Pan Am compound, having gone into the nearby town of Sume. After the first string of bombs hit, Max returned and got his car picked Wells up and drove to the crossroads of Agat and Agana. Out on the reef, he met Everett Penning, George Blackett, and Fred Oppenborn, three of the Pan Am radio operators, who had drove over with a batch of fellows in one of the Pacific Naval Air Base contractor's truck. They drove off in a caravan to the Mount Almagosa area. Max Brodowski. We watched from the mountain out to the harbor as the USS Penguin, a minesweeper from World War I, put up a valiant but losing battle, its 1 3-inch gun being the only sizable gun to defend strategically located Guam. Dean Brutton. The USS Penguin, the small minesweeper in the harbor, gave a good account of herself, pouring such a hail of fire against the attacking planes that on subsequent raids they kept a noticeably respectful altitude. Finally, the little vessel suffered so heavily that her captain tried to take her out to the middle of the channel where she could block incoming ships, where she could never again be raised, and there she sank. That night, we heard an English-speaking announcer on the Tokyo radio report the sinking of an American battleship at Guam. Harold Brinkerhoff. Reports began coming in from Petey and Sumé. A while later, a truck drove up with a crew of the minesweeper USS Penguin. The Penguin had not been hit directly, but a near miss had put numerous shrapnel holes through her side, and Captain White had been killed and 8 sailors were wounded. The Penguin could only do 10 or 12 knots, so it had no chance of escape. The crew took her into the deeper water off the town of Agat and scuttled her. Many of the sailors were cut badly by the coral coming in over the reef. They had their feet wrapped in cloth or safety belts. An old tanker, the USS Barnes, was sitting in the harbor and could not be moved as she had 200,000 gallons of oil aboard. The planes tried bombing her but never made a hit. One man aboard was wounded by flying shrapnel. The Barnes commanding officer would not let her be scuttled. Charles Gregg. The Marine barracks were hit bad also, as well as the golf course, corner supply office, and the PNAB contractor's warehouse. The USS Barnes was strafed, but no bombs hit the ship. The USS Penguin had lifted anchor to depart. She returned fire and forced the bombers up to approximately 5,000 feet. The Pan American compound is the worst area hit and apparently was the Japanese main objective. Whereas the Chamorros kept running during the strafing, the rest of us hit the ground. Bob Vaughn and I returned to the terminal office. We tried to open the safe during the bombing. It took 4 attempts, while the Japanese planes were still bombing, was too nervous to work the combination. Failed. Then machine gun bullets went through the office, right over our heads, and seconds later, a bomb landed outside the window. 1 bomb. Gathered other confidential papers, including the Pan Am code book, and ran from the office with planes still over our heads. Saw 2 Pan American men badly injured. Bob Vaughn, a Marine guard, and I ran over to the other Pan American station wagon and loaded the injured Chamorro workers inside. Vaughn then drove away from the terminal, headed towards the hospital. One of the injured Pan American men, by the name of Cruz, was disemboweled by the strafing. Mr. Schaffaros was the other injured Pan American man. I drove the Buick, started driving towards the cable company's radio station, and picked up Al Hameliff, the Pan Am steward, on the way. The Buick stalled over by the Marine compound, so we abandoned it and headed out on foot. Past 2 Navy personnel I recognized, Starr and Marks. They were leading a large group of men into the boondocks. 9:30 a.m. found Dick Arvidsson and a sailor by the name of Kohler, and took them with us to the radio station. The last bomber had left in a north-northeast direction. Our last message had been received by Wake in Midway and was relayed to the San Francisco headquarters. We sent a final message giving the number of casualties and damage up to that time, 9:50 a.m. At approximately 9:50, we found George Conklin, and he transmitted our final message. XXX, WPAN, emergency, emergency, bombing, casualties, damage. 10 a.m. Al Hamilef and I returned to the Pan American staff quarters. I split from Al and changed my conspicuous white uniform for dark clothes. Al and I then went through the bombed Pan American Hotel and all the other Pan Am buildings, searching for personnel. They were all out of the buildings, but one of the Chamorro gardeners was on the grass in front of the office, dead, shot through his stomach and an arm by 50 caliber bullets. We made arrangements for the Marine Corpsman to take the body to the hospital morgue. I entered my office and removed any remaining papers which had not been taken after the bombing by Jim Thomas, my assistant. Found the safe had been opened by someone and its contents were gone. Went into Max's shop, took some medical supplies, a first aid kit, loaded everything into the bed of the Pan Am truck, and headed out to the boondocks, driving along the road leading from the rear of the radio transmitter building. Bob Vaughn. During the initial raid, I was with Chuck Gregg in the Pan Am office. When we were leaving his office, we found one of the local natives wounded from bomb fragments. I took him and another Pan Am man to the Navy hospital. Dick Arvidsson. I had been working in the radio station on the shift that commenced about midnight and ended around 6 or 7 in the morning. I've been sending and receiving radio messages in connection with a planned flight for a clipper from Wake to Guam later that morning. The aircraft was scheduled to leave Wake at about sunrise and arrive in Guam in the afternoon. The aircraft did depart Wake, but after flying for a few hours, it was turned back to Wake after Pan Am Airways became aware of the attacks at Pearl Harbor. After coming off the radio watch in the early morning, I proceeded to the Pan Am Hotel, and while having a cup of coffee with another Pan Am employee, we heard aircraft engines, a startling sound since there was no known aircraft in the area. We realized they were not American aircraft when we heard the crash of bombs nearby. We quickly evacuated the hotel and hid in some shrubbery nearby. Soon thereafter, we witnessed a bomb penetrate the roof of the hotel, causing extensive damage. The Japanese aircraft were equipped with machine gunners in a tail position that were strafing the ground after the aircraft made its bomb run. Many of the Guam natives were running and were open, moving targets for the machine gunners. We tried shouting to the Chamorros to take cover and don't move, but some were hit by machine gun fire. About 6 Japanese aircraft were involved in the raid. These were older biplanes that had flown from Tinian, an adjacent island. The air raid lasted approximately 30 minutes. After the raid, Pan Am personnel gradually assembled in the Sumé area near Pan Am's facilities. 11:30 a.m. After collecting a few basic items such as food and other necessities, the Pan Am staff evacuated to the interior area of the island in anticipating the further air raids. The name of the area we met is called the FEMA District. Bryant Sterling, Monday, December 8th. Bombs fell at 8:40 a.m. Tried to telephone Sumé from the field office. No luck. Notice 4 seaplanes flying high in formation. As I walked back to the job site, I noticed some natives running. They said Sume was on fire. I ordered them back to work. "But Mr. Sterling, I just saw them drop a bomb on Sume," said Hector Camacho. The remaining natives were ordered to leave their posts. I sent them home towards Agana. I ordered the driver to leave the truck in the bushes. I locked the office, then my car wouldn't start, so I got a push. Picked up a load of natives whose families lived in Sume. Met Clark Eldridge and Colonel McNulty in the road near the company's office. They reported an exodus from Sume. The warehouse had been bombed, the gas tanks were burning, the Pan Am kitchen was in ruins, several natives were dead, and the Marines had fled to the boondocks. A few of them tried to man a machine gun in the bushes. I went to my room, pocketed my money. Picked up Art Okapinti and Dick Devine. Dick was almost hysterical because the plane shot the front tire off his motorcycle. We drove off towards Agat. We passed many trucks hauling food. They were hiding supplies in the natives' homes. Some cars had stalled in the road, and others had turned over at the roadside. The road was crowded with fleeing natives. Cars stalled in front of us, so we had to stop. Dick Devine climbed out and ran for the boondocks. Could hear the roar of planes overhead. Art Okapinti and I drove to Agat. We drove on, passing Agat, and continued driving out on FEMA Road towards the reservoir. We stopped on top of the hill to watch the planes over Sume. The radio station at Siguban was heavily bombed. Gasoline tanks were still throwing out clouds of black smoke. We drove back towards the main office, and we stopped off at the garage in the warehouse. Reed Hubbard, Don Wallace, and about 15 others were at the reservoir. We heard more planes, so we headed for the boondocks. We decided to go to Petey and pick up some trucks at Cabras Island, so we piled into my Chrysler. The roar of the motor sends men scurrying towards bushes. We picked up water containers out of the field office. Don Wallace, Art Okapinti, Ken Frazier, and Bill Gordonier joined me in the car. Finally, we arrived in Petey. We needed to pick up the trucks. Some were already coming up from Cabras Island. First, we stopped at Aguada to pick up gas, then we went back to the field office, formed a caravan of three cars to head for Agat. We arrived at Agat where we met Bill Falvey. We decided to pick up the Ford V8 truck to haul food to the hills. Art Okapinti, Ken Frazier, and myself drove back in my Chrysler. I dropped Ken Frazier at Frank Borja's farmhouse to help unload the grub from trucks. Found the Ford truck 1 mile past Aguada in the bushes to the right of the road. Parked the Chrysler on the left side of the road under some palm trees. I took the rotor head off the distributor. Art Okapinti and I climbed into the Ford V8 truck and headed for our camp to pick up some more grub. We went to the camp's kitchen where we found Walt Pleitner. He says the surplus food is in the old powder magazine. He gave us a big piece of bologna. Art Okapinti and I rushed to our rooms and picked up our clothes. I grabbed a hammer, a saw, and one machete. We headed back to the truck. Some natives hopped in with us. We found the entrance to the powder magazine. Plenty of food. We loaded figs, sugar, flour, and tea into the truck. Each of us ate a can of pineapple. We also loaded coffee, 5 gallons of olive oil, canned pineapple, canned milk, cereals, salt, etc., got the truck loaded up, and headed for Almagosa Mountain. Art Okapinti rode with Don Wallace, who passes us in the opposite direction in a truck. I finally arrived at Almagosa. The Marines were in charge of caching the food. There was food in the bushes every place. Thus concludes episode 2 of the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. We'll continue with the next episode with Bryant Sterling's narrative. And for now, I'd like to thank you for listening.